Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Writer's Block. Yes, people, it's Sunday evening here in lovely Skopje, Macedonia. It's been a hot day, now it's a cold night, and with me here I have Josh Neal, a clinical psychologist from Understand, or are you a university type? Well, I'll remember later on, and we have him on to discuss his book, American Extremist, and it sounds very extreme. It sounds like he's introducing a new heel in WWE in Worldwide Wrestling Federation, but it's actually very, very highly intellectual. It's a dense text which talks about, well, I don't know, I would be going, my ears would be going red, and I would be checking my hat for bees, reading it. But hey, hello there, Josh, and welcome to the Writer's Block.
Thanks for having me on. That's a really cool intro you got there.
Well, thank you. It's amazing what you can do with 5 minutes in an editing software.
Well, I don't have that patience. That's five more minutes than I would have given it. So very cool.
Right. So anyways, Josh, you've been around the American extremist and the, let's call it, dissident right scene for some time now. I first started following you in 2019, and I always thought your shows were very charming, and of course your friend and partner, Mr. Jefferson Lee, tell him I said hi, I'm a big fan, you could say, and why don't you introduce yourself to someone who may be a newcomer, someone who may not have heard of you, and maybe people who do know you, maybe we can catch up a little. Where have you been, low, these 2 years?
Yeah, probably formally threw my hat in the ring, summer of 2018, making little, you know, videos here and there. Figured that wasn't a good format for me to do what I wanted to do, which was basically dialogue with a whole bunch of new ideas and a different worldview that I had previously only been dimly aware of. And I went right into this, and Jefferson Lee and I had been podcasting for a few years as like post, like Trumpian post libertarians. And that quickly was worn away by how terrible Trump was, at least in our opinions. I mean, the guy lost, so probably a lot of the people's opinions. And we tried to do something different, and then I was like, yeah, you know, this live stream conversation thing is pretty cool, and people like Kevin McDonald were very pleasant and totally agreeable to talk to nobody like me. And yeah, that went on for a few years working with a bunch of different people. And in the current iteration, if you don't know me or are just catching up, people, lovely people like yourself, if you invite me on, I talk, but mostly I write. And the subject of the first book is American Extremist. And it is, you know, partly informed by my experience doing this, because obviously this was educational, but it's also kind of just the culmination of, like, as you said at the beginning, I did study clinical psychology, never was licensed, so I didn't practice in that capacity. But it is the culmination of really a lifetime of thinking about people and political differences, and really like what are, because one of the arguments I make in the book is, you know, we're not so much doing an ideological conflict. It's kind of more, it's earthier than that. And I think the book goes a long way to explaining, I think, that fact.
Well, my own experience, both as a theoretician of politics and as a practitioner of politics, and I let the one feed off the other for those of us who actually know, have been watching the show and following me for a long time, is that that's actually how these things go, usually. That's basically what we consider to be ideology is very surface level. It's but we are going to get into the nitty-gritty of your book, of your work, Josh. First of all, you know, this is a show. We have our sponsors, and we have to say, first of all, people, you got the Entropy link, and if our illustrious and heroic mods would just dump that into the DLive and Odyssey chats so people can donate and ask questions of me, of Josh Neal. And if, especially if you want to know something about psychology, about the psychology of the extremist, whether leftist extremist, rightist extremist, or the psychology of the person who can actually get us out of this mess, which I believe Josh calls the radical, just pump him here. Josh does not make these appearances very often. Last time he did a show was with Keith Woods and Joel Davis. I believe you were discussing the debate with, what's his name, Logo Daedalus, where Keith was discussing socialism versus, well, let's call it mid-century German statism. So yeah, it's once in a, only once in a blue moon that Mr. Neal appears in video form. So you might want to ask him some questions. You might want to drop some donations. And of course, as always, with me is my trusty cup of Alaska Chaga tea. Now, it's a mushroom which apparently grows on the rocks of Alaska, but it's very healthy to drink. And yeah, my family asked me, what is this thing I got? Oh, it's a mushroom tea from Alaska. And they assumed I was doing drugs because, hey, what else am I going to do with my life? But no, it's actually not hallucinogenic. It's good for you. It's good tea, as the girls in cartoon shows tend to say. Mm. Oh, that's actually delicious. And no, it's, and of course, Alaska Chaga. He's a supporter of this show. He's a friend of this channel, and he's our guy. So go grow his business. And I hear he's started selling soap as well. This is Alaska Chaga soap. And people, if I were able to live stream smell, I would live stream the shit out of this smell, because it's actually divine. And I'm taking baths with the other soap brick he sent me, and it's actually yeah, I feel squeaky clean after that. Well, anyways, I think that's all of the panhandling and the shilling and the crass financial concerns out of the way. Josh, I love your book. It's very entertaining to read. It's big and thick. It makes me look like an intellectual in the park. But I gotta tell you, I also watch The Sopranos. And I know a psychiatry is just a racket for the Jews. So are you trying to reclaim psychology and psychiatry for the right here? Is that what you're getting at?
Yeah, thanks. Appreciate that. It's from a very young age, there are two things that were the most interesting thing to me: space and like the human mind. And I realized I was not a mathematician, so space was never going to happen. But the philosophy of mind never changed. And it seems to me that psychology is kind of like the first philosophy or the first philosophical practice, because that's the thing that's kind of most immediately consequential to us, ethics, all that kind of thing. There's a psychological aspect to it. So it's, to me, it's like one of the oldest disciplines. And I think the fact that it has been, put it this way, especially over the last 50 years, practiced so poorly is, you know, it's a travesty. And even like disciplines like sociology or whatever, which have terrible reputations just because of like third rate, academics doing something on Foucault for the million and one time. Makes it look bad, which is unfair, because I think sociology is also like one of those super primary, really interesting first philosophical practices. But am I trying to take it back for the right? A little bit. I think there's utility to it. I mean, put it this way, there are certain kind of like right-wing psychologies that I think are more of a mixed bag than anything I would put out. Like people will say all the time, like psychoanalysis or whatever, it's non-empirical, it's totally suspect. But then you have something like evolutionary psychology, which is for all intents and purposes right wing, because it deals with some of its subjects are race and IQ and sex and just things that are thorny problems for the neoliberal order. And I think there's more problems with evolutionary psychology than psychoanalysis, but because of, and I think this is a misconception, really, I think Nietzsche probably invented psychoanalysis, certainly before Freud. And there's a whole long, I'm going off on a tangent here, so I apologize. But there's like a whole long, like conspiracy of Freud's career as to whether or not he had read Nietzsche's writings, and that was influential to his thinking. There's, I think, he's on the record of saying he was not familiar with Nietzsche, but then his letters to his colleagues suggested maybe otherwise. People like Jung were, I think, very honest about the influence that Nietzsche had on his thinking. And if you want to go down that route, then you could say, well, maybe Schopenhauer did it before Nietzsche, and then so on and so forth, back to Aristotle and Plato, which reinforces my point that this stuff has always been around, and the kind of knee-jerk reactionary hostility, while certainly it has been earned, I think is not conducive moving forward. So short answer, yes, I am.
Right. It's good to know. Well, my opinion of it is that basically psychology and psychiatry arose when Nietzsche declared God to be dead, and God was indeed dead in the sense that people in the West no longer had any faith. So what was previously conceptualized through religious and philosophical practice, it really just fell to secular men like psychologists and psychiatrists, because, you know, that's the thing. You take away God, you take away religion, but the necessity for God and religion from man do not go away. So yeah, you could say that psychology and psychiatry are an attempt to paper over that difference. Whether they are successful or not, or whether they are a continuation of the old tradition, it remains to be seen. I am, of course, a great admirer of Carl Gustav Jung, precisely because he was very honest about what he was doing. And I think he realized that you can't do psychology, you cannot heal souls without God, without religion. And that's very refreshing if your conception of the psychologist is the staunchly atheistic Freud, or people like B.F. Skinner and the behavioralists, who just basically treat you like a moist robot. And I really hate it when I hear the whole moist robot hypothesis. No, even though I have become almost notorious in these circles for disdaining normies, I recognize that each human being actually has a soul. We have donations on DLive. We have a Ninjagini donated to us from Alyaska Chaga. Well, thank you for that, kind sir, and I appreciate your donation and your fine product. We have the European housewife has just followed us, and I know for a fact she was active in the Patriotic Alternative chat. So cheers to you. I'm grateful for that follow. Old Man Yinzer has donated a diamond on DLive, and we have a Ninjagini from Eloise 88. Now that is a very interesting number. It might need a 14 to complete the conceptual hold, so get to it, chop chop. Well, I think, and of course we have Ultimate Truth and Sia Kyle following. Well, thank you for that, kind sirs. Okay, now I think that's a good opening there, right? We have decided to reclaim psychology for the dissident right. Now, Jordan Peterson may have been doing something for the mainstream right. He's been using these psychological insights, but I don't think he presents a whole picture of the human psyche to be seen. What you describe in the book, first of all, let's lead in with, well, someone who, from my reading, is your greatest influence, and that's Andrei Lobachevsky. And I'm hoping I'm pronouncing that right. I'm horrible with Polish names. But he's a Polish psychiatrist, someone who was educated, the last of the Polish psychiatrists to be educated outside the Soviet systems, before the Soviet system. And he made his life's work the study of, well, evil, and his book is called Poneurology, you know, political poneurology. Would you introduce for the audience, some who may have not even come across this researcher, the major ideas and how he has influenced you?
Yeah, sure. I discovered him fairly late, maybe only in the last few years. And as I was having the idea to write this book, I picked it up off the shelf. I was like, no better time to read this than right now. And his story is a little bit suspect. I guess if you do a quick Google search, you'll have mostly forum comments and posts, people questioning the authenticity of this supposed person, because beyond this, there's not a lot else to find that I've seen about him. That's a little bit of intrigue, neither here nor there. Basically, he makes the argument that tyranny, political tyranny, is just the consequence of dysfunctional biological types who are psychotically driven to pursue power. And virtually everything that you could say that goes wrong with politics is secondary to just this kind of community problem of who's in control. And these people are categorically, the opposite of the average person. He frequently uses the word like common people, normal people. Basically, that there's a normative evolved condition that we have that makes us amenable to order and beauty and truth and like civilizations that last or whatever. And then there's a second type of person who are effectively psychopaths that don't care about anything other than advancement of themselves personally. And to him, and this is like overly simplified, and I don't totally ascribe to everything that he's saying, but insofar as understanding tyrannical types, I think it's very accurate. These two are just kind of like the cycle of history is always psychopathic, antisocial types maneuver their way into institutions of power, and then they overturn the institutions, and then they overturn the societies, and then eventually the common normal people revolt, and the whole cycle kind of just continually perpetuates itself. So that's the long and short of it. Getting into some more of the particulars, he describes basically a handful of biological types of people who are form this nexus, the pathocratic nexus at the heart of every institution. And the first, you could say they almost match to like the IE tripartite model, where there's the spellbinder, who's this kind of priestly type of person, who the image that always comes to mind is Wormtongue in Lord of the Rings, just insinuates into some power structure, either through the force of their own charisma or by latching on to somebody with more social proof than them. Overtakes everything, starts, Bio-Leninism, you start filtering for biological and spiritual detritus, and then you just funnel those people into your society, into your institution. And then there's the second level would be like this, what he called a skirtoid. So it's kind of like shades of schizoid or schizotypal. I think he was writing this before those personality profiles were really solidified. At either rate,
I'm sorry, what does that mean, skirtoid? Why is he calling it a skirtoid?
yeah, it's a good question. Basically, these are in common parlance, they would be it's like schizotypal personality disordered people. So they're paranoid, to and schizotypal, schizoid, they're different. Fundamentally different, but so probably closer to schizoidal, where they have fanciful thinking, paranoia, few relationships outside of immediate primary bonds, and that's what he saw as kind of the second rung of the pathocracy. These were martial types. These were a very aggressive, traditionally conservative. Now, Lobachevsky ascribed a racial characteristic to these, to the breakdown of these types, and maybe I'll leave to the audience's imagination, maybe how he
We
might.
are streaming to Odyssey and DLive, so you may be free with
Oh, okay.
basically, do not censor yourself. I mean, obviously,
No
no
slurs.
excessive use of racial slurs, but if you want to name the Jew, you want to name the Scot. I frequently name the Scot. You want to name the Irishman? I express all of my negative views of groups of people here freely. But yeah, for the time being, we are allowed to express our views as they are on DLive and Odyssey. So just go ahead. I'm very interested to hear.
Okay.
This.
So the Skirtoids basically were Slavs, and you got to keep in mind where he is, where he's studying at this time in history. He's in Poland, so Central Europe, and you have all these different countries that are, you know, broadly majoritarian ethnic, but also have weird pockets. Like my family's from Czechoslovakia; it's kind of like one of those fake countries. There's like other ethnicities that have been. Well, it doesn't exist anymore, for one, but when it did exist, it was like a weird post-Prussian, pre-Third Reich German, just weird situation, as I understand it.
I'm sorry, your family are Czechs or are they Germans?
Czech, technically, but the name is German.
Well, that's actually very common in the Czech Republic.
Yeah.
Okay. But anyways, about the skirt, so we're both... Well, you're more Skirtoid than I am, but go ahead.
And the Spellbinders were, and by his own admission, in his own studies, repeatedly, empirically demonstrated, were Jews. So, but you know, you can soften that a little bit if you just simply say, what are we talking about? Central Europe at that time, it's predominantly going to be, you know, those two types of people, or it wouldn't be uncommon. And so... take that from that what you will, but then you have third rung. These are jackals, and that's like total bio-Leninism, maybe not racially identified in any particular way. And these are just like, you know, Chris Nolan's Joker, like people who are just in it for havoc and chaos and maybe just useful pawns of the two higher.
But lower IQ, maybe.
Almost certainly, yeah. Mm-hmm. They're workers, I guess, effectively, if you want to keep going with that, the Indo-European model.
Yeah, this actually sounds very much like a twisted mirror of the Indo-European caste division. So you have the priest Brahmin, you know, the priest is mirrored in the Spellbinder, the Kshatriya, the warrior in the Skirtoid. I'm sorry, I'm having trouble wrapping my head around the word, the concept.
Yeah,
I know the type. Right? my grandma would say, I know your damn type. And yeah, I know the type. Having worked in corporate contexts and academic contexts, I definitely know both the Spellbinder and the Skirtoid. And I've seen a few jackals in my life as well. And of course, the jackals are a twisted laboratories, a twisted... I wouldn't say Vaishya, but they are one of the lower Varnas. That sounds interesting. So let's have a... How would you model a Spellbinder takeover of a... Let's say a company. Let's say they make shoes. What would the Spellbinder do to insinuate himself and start parasitizing on this institution?
Yeah, so good question. I'm working on an essay now that I think... more fundamentally answers what you're asking. But there's a few common things, right? So exploitation, I mean, they would all factor around like certain themes, I think. Exploitation, sabotage, sabotage might be in a situation where like the Spellbinder doesn't have both hands on the wheel, so to speak, and they have to negotiate with existing power players, or there's some social dynamic that they don't have total mastery over. And then it's just about saddling up to whoever's the most well-liked or most successful individual, and then, you know, whispering in the ear and casting doubt, insinuating things, subverting different things, and playing on the kind of trust that the social dynamic already had. Mm-hmm. And I would say that's if they're not like really firmly in control, then that's something that happens. On the other hand, if there really isn't any competition, or it's easier for them to subdue other competitors or whatever the existing power structure was, then it's just through a kind of, I think it's more direct, it's more of like, it looks like a regular cult It looks like any kind of ritualistic practice, not too distinct from anything you've probably seen. That's what I had noticed. I don't know, maybe there's more to it. The actual mechanics, it's one of those things where, like, anyone who's had the misfortune of dealing with people who have personality disorders or whatever over long periods of time, is you become very viscerally aware of the kinds of games and social dynamics that play out. So if you've never had that experience, I'm glad. But it also is like you're not inoculated with an understanding of how these types of situations play out. So has its downsides too, I suppose.
Yeah, it's a privilege of I guess the privilege of not knowing how these things work is being surrounded, the privilege of growing up in a society where the majority of the people, and specifically a majority of influential people, are sane, something which was a privilege of our ancestors, which we are, I guess, rapidly losing. I think this models actually very well on. I know you have your disagreements with them, and I have disagreements with them too, but the neo-reactionaries would often say that the progressive methodology for taking over an institution is, find a respected institution, infiltrate it, kill it, gut it, wear it like a skin suit. And when the or Vox, they would call it converge. When an institution is converged, this is where the management team is all spellbinders, I guess. So that's very interesting. The role of the jackals, they are the military types. They are, paranoid, they're schizotypal, so I'm expecting flat effect there. But any more you can say about this cast of people, the Skirtoids, sorry, not the jackals, the Skirtoids.
Yeah, I mean, in his writing, he makes it pretty clear that they're very, don't know if he would say socially conservative, but just conservative temperamentally, and almost not capable of interacting outside of a strict kind of martial or military order. Like there's one passage where he talks about them basically being kind of adrift in times of peace, because they're just really meant for brutal violence and warfare and domination and hierarchy and things like that. And then when they're just dad at the dinner table, they're kind of like neutered and ineffectual and kind of weirdly brutal and paranoid. So I mean that I think probably lots of people have had an experience of maybe their uncle was in Vietnam or whatever the case was. They know somebody older who had spent some part of their life in the service, and then like we're not really able to put everything together again outside of that. Or like famous boxers or athletes that are like John Jones in the UFC is a good example, like totally made for violence and then just can't like keep his domestic life together to save his career, to save his fighting career. I think that's pretty common. I think that's how you would identify that type.
That's interesting. Were it not something that Lobachevsky would insist is just a military phenomenon, I think that a disturbing number of men in particular would qualify, not specifically because they're brutal or militaristic, but they try to treat private life with the grammar of business life. And I have male relatives. Well, actually, the majority of my male relatives are very, 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 I wouldn't say incapable, but very little, there's very little capability of treating private life with non-business grammar. I don't think they understand that the grammar of business, and this is regardless of the business, every sector imaginable, law, energy, military, medicine. I have a lot of male relatives, and a lot of them. And again, I come from a Slavic country, and my family is more Slavic than most people around here. So maybe it's a racial thing, but I'm also more German than Slavic genetically. So that's something to think about. I think you can also see this in Germans. You see it all over the place, all over the world, really. Men just trying to treat their private life with the logic, with the grammar, more specifically, of their business life. So if you take out the military element, this actually applies to a lot of men. A lot of men we would actually call honorable, respectable, middle-class men.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know if it's a dysfunction or if it's a dysfunction insofar as they are under the, call it glamour or charm of a spellbinder. And I've commented often that right-wingers suffer from soldier brain, which is not a disease, but you tell them to do something and they do it, they don't really question it. You give them an objective to chase, they chase it and they catch it. Mm-hmm. That's the thing. But if there is someone evil throwing the stick or setting the objective of or dictating the terms of discussion, you can also see it in non-martial men, in highly intellectual, highly cerebral men. Mm-hmm. But they're going to do the absolute best of human work and labor and ingenuousness in chasing this particular objective, but they're not going to understand that the person who gave this objective to them, who set this frame of thinking, is evil and is working directly against their interest. We're seeing it with the American military, which is overwhelmingly majority white and male and heterosexual, furiously at work at dismantling America, dismantling whiteness, dismantling understanding white rage, or whatever the hell these people are doing, I guess. But you see it in other contexts, just not just the military.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I agree. If you want to use Jungian terms, it's kind of a little bit of like the tyrannical king, like just you see like where that almost like borderline Apollonian mentality has embedded in it its own catastrophe, because you just have very dutiful, conscientious, low neurotic types that are, yeah, they're going to pleasantly hum along without perhaps ever coming across any kind of problem so profound that they'd have to like stop and think about, oh, maybe this whole enterprise is total trash. So yeah, it's not just martial, it's a particular masculine character, I think.
But it's a disease specifically of professional men, you know. Mm-hmm. That's the thing. Military is one of the professions, one that has lowest tolerance for, well, basically questioning orders, let's call it what it is. We want to call it creativity, but at some point it is questioning orders. I think it's very visible in the military. It's also perhaps very visible in the police, but everywhere where you need diligent men obeying orders in hierarchical settings, you can find this neurotype. You can find it in a university. You can find it in a court of law. You know, as an attorney, mm-hmm. I have experience. A lot of lawyers are like this. If we take out the military element, I mean.
Mm-hmm.
Right. We have donations. We have 8 ice creams from Gadius Maximus and 8 lemons from Mr. Gadius Maximus. Well, thank you for that, sir. And that number is very symbolic. I wonder if Mr. 88 was one of these cartoids. He was a soldier at one point, but he was also a creative type. And Slog has donated 14 lemons. That is greatly appreciated. These are all DLive donations, and we appreciate them. And let me just double-check Entropy. And folks, you want to ask Mr. Neil questions, you want to ask me questions, you want to comment on something, you just plain want to insult us, do it through Entropy. They take less money, and the Entropy devs, the Entropy people are committed to free speech, and that's something I can respect. They have close relations with many of our friends and allies, with Mr. Jean-Francois Gariapi and Mark Collett, that I know of, possibly someone else. So we prefer Entropy donations, right? We are not going to turn back your DLive donations or Odyssey Super Chats, but we prefer the Entropy donations. And as I'm speaking, people are giving us diamonds on DLive. a diamond from Old Man Yinzer, a diamond from the Thin Red Line, and a diamond from Hadrian, or it's right. And Hadrian was indeed right. That wall was the best thing. Scots really ought to be cordoned off from civilized society. So salute, salute, salute. Anyways, Josh, I'm sorry?
What's the anti-Scot thing? Is this because they're really behind the Enlightenment? Like, what's the problem with the Scots?
No, it's not. It's a joke. I'm gearing up for interactions with a certain dangerous haggis, you might call him. So I'm trying to work out a little rivalry here. We are, I've mentioned before, content creators. We are like priests, but we're also like boxers. We have interactions, we have rubbers, we have rivalries, we have friendships. It's a little like worldwide wrestling, but it's real. So it's more like boxing, you could say. Well, and more real than boxing, because the champ is not, you know, there's no paper champs propped up so they can humiliate white men conceptually. We can go into boxing some other time, though. We are here to discuss right-wing psychology. We are here to reclaim the psychological discipline for the radical right. And we have a donation from Slog on DLive. He has just given us a diamond. And he says, for the best mods on DLive. Well, yes, I will agree. We have Gadius Maximus and Bartleby absolutely dominating the chat with their heroic moderation. And I without them, I would have to do real work. That's terrible. That's terrible. And another donation from the Thin Red Line, he gives a diamond on DLive and says, best mods. I wholeheartedly agree, kind sir. And let me just double check that entropy page once more, and then we can move on. Unless you have anything to add on the Skirtoid Spellbinder Jackal Divide, Josh?
Not really, other than to say, because we've said the least about the Jackal, is that I mean, these are your kind of disposable street level thugs that enforce whatever needs to be enforced, instigate whatever needs to be instigated. So Antifa would be an obvious example of that. Proud Boys, probably. I'm hesitant to say that because obviously when we're comparing the two, there's a far less real responsibility and blame we can lay at the groups of people like the Proud Boys, where anything I'd say about them would be more ideologically kind of critical, but fundamentally they serve the same role, so it kind of doesn't make a world of difference. And then you could think to historical examples when fascism was on the rise the first time around, of, you know, you had effectively these very aggressive non-ideological types patrolling, and they have very limited lifespans.
The Sturmabteilung, you mean?
Say it again?
The black shirts.
Yes,
the black shirts, the Sturmabteilung in Germany, maybe exactly. Even the Iron Guard in Romania. I don't know. Yeah, there is. So I don't think the inclusion of the Jackals is controversial in any way. We all know people like that. You know, we don't necessarily. I mean, you can always feel a little of revulsion towards just the lowbrow nature of it all, the obvious low IQ, the obvious way they revel in the violence. To them, sure. The violence is an excuse. The ideology or the conviction is an excuse to get down and dirty and do disgusting things. And even on the internet, in the online right, I can think of a couple of jackals, even though they don't engage in violence, they engage in this nasty nihilism, which is, I'm just so tired of it, I guess.
Well, you know, when and again, I'm hesitant to give any credence to the types of things our enemies would say, but they will frequently conflate worldviews, statements, whatever, images as violence. And obviously we look at that and laugh because it's just a pretext for further persecution. But on the flip side, I mean, and it almost don't want to say this, but I already am, so I'll keep going. You know, the little kernel of truth there is that, and this is the argument I make throughout the book, which is that, you know, the violence that you genuinely at the level of a civilization want to be concerned with is the non-violent violence, the non-lethal violence, where it's the casual pulling at the strings of the social order, and whether that's usury, violence. I'm not a Christian, but the seven deadly sins have a lot going for them in terms of really describing the things that will destroy your society.
They are recognized as sins not only by Christianity, but by every current major religion and by every pagan religious system that I have researched. So, you don't get away with the, pride and lust and gluttony if you're an Odinist or if you worship the Greek gods. They punish you for these things too. I mean, ancient myth is replete with men falling to these sins and being punished for it. And this is a little digression. I am a Christian, an Orthodox Christian, but I have respect for people of, I hear they like to be called native faith. They'll find their way to Christ eventually, unless they're the kind of people who fetishize, being bad. The people who become pagans so they can rape, pillage, and burn or whatever, or just give themselves into lust and wrath and pride. And fortunately for us, I most of these people I know are on the either political left or these non-ideological hedonic jackals, so you can just dismiss them out of hand. But they do exist. They do exist. And then, there's a lot of Christian, nominal Christians, I would say, who also fit that bill. But it is something to think about. Faiths which function, faiths which are healthy, sanction these behaviors because these are antisocial behaviors, as elucidated in the seven deadly sins. Now, I wrote, it was more, well, maybe 6 months ago. I don't really remember anymore. It was a time in my life where I was a little frustrated, a little, you could say, depressed. I'm unfortunately, I very easily fall prey to, I guess you people call it seasonal affective disorder or whatever. So I have these weather-bound cycles where I'm depressed or no. And I was thinking about, building up a network of friends, a network of supporters here, and just thinking with the human material I have to work with over here on the far right. And I wrote an article which is called "The Struggle is Real," and if our moderators would be kind enough to post it in the chat. And I wrote about encountering several people here in Macedonia who, call themselves to be of the far right, but I just found them to be lacking in a will to do anything constructive and productive, but rather they were focused on what I could only describe as self-annihilation. I thought for a while, and I discovered that basically if they followed their own purported and stated belief system to the end, they would end up just committing very long and drawn out suicide by cop, and it would be very long and very drawn out, and it would be worthy of song in their heads, I guess, but it would still be suicide, self-annihilation sorts. And I think we can use this, and of course I sent you the article to read before we started the show, I think we can use it as a springboard from which we can jump into the notion of the extremist, the actual meat and potatoes, to avoid offense to the Irish, of your book. You start with the annihilation instinct, which I believe is mostly turned inward in modernity. Would you please take it away?
Yeah, so very expertly teed up for me. Thank you. It's a profound thing, and the consequences of, I think, are not really too well appreciated. The death instinct, as per Freud, which really came from a client of his who went on later to her own career as a physician and psychoanalyst, made this distinction that there's a creative impulse behind destruction, and that's kind of something that's more significant and something to drive after, and probably has more explanatory power than just the Freudian, like, you know, conservation, self-annihilation, like you're saying before, this continual regress into nothingness, which more or less what he said the death principle was, the death instinct, is that it's just this desire to move backwards into a non-conscious or organic kind of material form, something like that. And that's the Freudian idea of the death instinct, which is, in my mind, it's not wrong, because definitely there are people that embody that, but it's not ideal. That defines the extremist, and the kind of the other notion from Sabina Spielrun is more befitting what somebody with radical views should want, which is, okay, yeah, we're going to destroy America. what do they always say? Smash the patriarchy. We're going to eat the rich. We're going to all of these political slogans. Yeah, that's if you want to do that, and there's something that you're looking to replace it with, then that's the correct impulse. That's the one that's going to have the most significant long-term positive impact. Simply that, you know, if I'm here just to be violent and transgressive, I mean, I think more fundamentally, like, what you figure out is probably something we all maybe should have understood sooner. Like, really political types are a very marginal super minority of people, and extremism is what probably bubbles up around radical circles, because the social energy and excitement of something new, Italian futurism or like Stalinist realism or whatever, has a ripple effect that the people it's rippling towards can never hope to understand or grasp. I think this is a weird analogy, but I think of the movie Silence by Scorsese, where you have these, I think, Portuguese Catholic missionaries trying to convert these local Japanese folk in Japan, native Japanese men. And their conception of God is like, one of the major plot points is that when we say the sun, they think the thing in the sky, and they totally miss all of the theological significance of why you should give yourself to Christ and all that kind of thing. And it's like, there's just a certain point where you can't really extend the meaning of something to certain types of people. And the Adam Waffens or whoever, you know, setting aside the fact that they are almost always funded by the FBI or something, or they have FBI informants or whatever, they're paying some guy.
Setting aside the glow nagger issue, I mean, when you think of the guy who's screaming, you know, let's just go out and say it, gas the kikes, race war now. I think it, you know, it was fun in 2016. It was edgy. It was transgressive. It was supremely naughty. Is that what we really want? I mean, I want my people to survive. More generally, I want white people to survive. That does not, a race war would not go in our advantage right now, or maybe ever, you know. And the first thing, again, is, so at some point, I guess, you start realizing for many people, it's not about, okay, let's take political power so we can, you know, save our people so we can do good. It's take political power so we can do violence, so we can gas the kikes, race war now. And because you realize you're never getting people on that platform, you're never getting white people on that platform ever. Because white people are just, the majority of us, I guess, are not temperamentally genocidal, you know? So it's basically just a way for you to alienate yourself and thus basically complete this long, drawn out and roundabout self-annihilation.
Yeah, I think the kind of existential truth of democracy is that for most people, the political process is just something you can wield to club the guy you hate with. And that's part of politics, but that's not everything. And it's also these same people who don't have anything creative to offer as a response to the multiple fronts of crisis that we're dealing with. The old saying, if you have a hammer, everything looks like a nail. Well, if you're dealing with an economic, ecological catastrophe in addition to a spiritual catastrophe, it's like we got to get the serious people in charge of this. And I think this is not to sound like elitist, like any kind of transgression is wrong, and anyone who practices it is juvenile and in the way, because there's good that comes from that. But it's the subculture psychology that I think a lot of people are in it for. That doesn't excite me. I don't think that advances any of the goals that you stated. So.
Yeah, it is. I mean, it's fun to be transgressive every once in a while, but it's good to remember that irreverence is not wit. They're not the same thing. That's the first thing. The second of all, building a subculture around, okay, even the hippies had a positive vision, right? And they won. Let's not kid ourselves. We live in hippie world right now, or we live in the world of aging hippies, which is even worse. And they were not chasing the death instincts, you could say. There was part of it, of course. There was not. There wasn't. But it was not focused on annihilation. And a lot of these aging liberal boomers, I guess, who used to be hippies or were hippie influenced, are just shocked and appalled by the destructive urges of the newer additions to the Biolenist coalition, to the extremist left, I guess. And from this, Josh, I think we can segue into the treatment of the extremist, of the antisocial extreme leftist and the antisocial extreme rightist. But first of all, a word from our sponsors, a word from our donors. We have $10 donation from Mr. Reed Johnson. Thank you for that, kind sir. And it's a question for Mr. Neil. As far as Mr. Neil knows, are there any known studies on the psychology of oligarchs, their extreme hoarding, usury propensity for social engineering, and political extremism like the Great Replacement? Or does the entire discipline just ignore this?
To ask the question is to answer it. I don't look. I'm not a nerd, and I say that word lovingly. So I'm not spending all day looking at the hottest thing off the press. So if it's there, I would be not knowing about it. But I'll put it this way: the discipline has spent 78 years or so denying left-wing authoritarianism, not studying it, implying that it's absurd to study it. There were a handful of studies, and now in the last 2 or 3 years, there's a relative flood of studies saying, "Oh, gee golly, this thing is real," and this was just this crazy ideological fetish of a few guys from a few decades ago. But it goes back to, if you remember, I think in 2017, there was a retraction from a major social psychology journal, I think, that claiming, or it must have been a personality journal, claiming that conservatives were more psychotic than liberals. And then they're like, oopsie, we read the whole study backwards. It turns out that liberals are more psychotic than conservatives. So there's, I mean, the history is pretty much not displaying that they're not interested in politically, socially meaningful psychological differences. So I would have to say probably none of that stuff is happening.
Well, for my part, I seem to remember at one point Dr. Robert Hare, the Canadian psychiatrist who is actually a pioneer of studying antisocial personality disorder, mentioning at one point making noises that he spent trawling Canada's prisons for, subject studies for psychopathy, but he would have been better employed at the stock exchange or in parliament. So he was just overwhelmed by the amount of psychopaths in business and politics. And But I would actually look for psychopaths in academia as well. The academic system is about as, you know, rigidly hierarchical and as chaotic as the corporate system. So it's definitely a good place for psychopaths to thrive and to basically engage in the spellbinding behavior we described at the beginning of this show, or it was more towards the middle. And so for my part, I know about that at least, but it's not actually a study. It's just this now retired researcher saying, well, I should have maybe looked for psychopaths at the stock exchange. And we have a $10 from Mr. Gadius Maximus, and he asks a question. If Mr. Neal were the president, which American extremist named Ted would he grant full pardon to?
Well, to the previous question, I mean, those studies have been done, I think, from researchers in Australia and New Zealand, and they estimated that something like 10% of world CEO types were clinically psychotic. So, I mean, this raises a question to me of whether this is like something that is just innate to humans in tightly enclosed competitive loops, where it kind of like the noisiest kid in the kindergarten classroom monopolizes all the attention, whereas it just like some social reality of unevenly distributed personality traits, and you're always going to have this super crazy spellbinder-esque dynamic at the heart of social institutions. I don't know. As an optimist, I'll say no. That's a very emblematic feature of liberal institutions. I would hope that whatever comes next does not demonstrate that. But to the question that was just asked, is Teddy Roosevelt, has he been canceled? Because I'd give him honorary.
That's interesting. I believe that he meant Ted Kaczynski, but
yes.
That's a good question. Would Ted Kaczynski fit into your definition of an extremist? Because the way you defined an extremist, this is not your grandpappy's extremism. You define extremism as a biological category, as a neurotype, I would put it. But you use the term biotype, which I believe they're the same thing, or more or less.
Yeah.
How would you try to explain this
impulse for the book. I resisted this impulse because this is a question where you can only make yourself look like a fool, I think, by answering. Think of like when Trump was elected and it's like 700 psychiatrists all unanimously agree this guy's fucking wacky. I don't want to put my credibility on the line and say one way or the other about Ted Kaczynski. What I would say that's consistent with the book is, again, you're looking at a guy that was involved in these, you know, MK Ultra adjacent Yale LSD studies, and that's the result of, if we want to say he's an extremist, let's just put it on the line, the responsibility of all of that goes to the academy and the federal government. So it's like, whatever you want to say about Ted Kaczynski or this person or that person, the real point I'm making is that this is a broad social, psychological phenomenon, political phenomenon. And while you would certainly look to identify individual actors who embody anything that I'm talking about, scapegoating Ted Kaczynski or some other person or other person does not really advance an understanding and a resistance to the thing that we all agree is terrible, which is like the actual institutional extremism. I would say, just short answer, no, because of all of the complicity of the whole social order in producing somebody like
this. This is very interesting to me. If you ask the normie on the street to, you know, ask them, is Ted Kaczynski an extremist? They would say yes. If you would ask them to name a right-wing extremist, many would name Ted Kaczynski, right? So, but by the definition given in American Extremist, Ted Kaczynski is actually not an extremist, or he's at least less extreme than a lot of other people. So if you would just use Mr. Uncle Ted as an example to bring this issue closer to our audience.
Yeah, it's think of it this way. Think of the argument that like DSA types, labor conscious types will say to you, it's like, well, you shouldn't be angry at Jamal or Jesus who stole your cashier job at the local grocery. You should be mad at the capitalists who brought him here. And it's like, okay, well, I think we've kind of implicitly accepted that argument. It's morally credible and I can't punch out Jamal and solve my problem or Jesus. So maybe this guy's right. Maybe I should pick it or something. I think it's the same principle here where it's like, we agree political violence is a problem. We agree that America is the number one purveyor of political violence. Let's kind of put the moral culpability at exactly the level of the social order that it belongs to. Fine, if we want to say Kaczynski is an extremist, I'm willing to go with you. So long as we say, you know, you treat that the same way that law enforcement might treat one lone drug dealer with a connection to a major kingpin, drug kingpin. It's like, okay, we're going to talk to this guy to get to the big fish. And that's, to me, the same mentality for anyone you want to pluck out. Dylan Roof, the guy who punched out Ron Paul's kid on his lawn for, like, mowing his lawn too aggressively or whatever. It's like, these people are just symptoms. We defer the real problem when we just put all of our attention on Ted Kaczynski, who did this one terrible thing or whatever the case is.
So basically, Ted Kaczynski is the product of a sick system, you would say. Not to absolve him of blame. Let's not kid ourselves here. Because sure, a lot of people go through the same stimuli as Uncle Ted, and well, they don't mail bombs to people.
Yes, this is true. But most people, even people who are really into psychedelics, don't get put through this insane, like, designed to break your nervous system experiment. So even that's kind of a weird example.
So we're going with the MK Ultra theory of Ted. I gotta admit ignorance of Uncle Ted outside of actually having read his manifesto. I do not know the Uncle Ted lore. So let's go with that.
I don't want to put it all on that either. It's holistic. Like, everything is failing. If any one piece gets too much of the responsibility, I feel like we're trying to keep a big, broad view. You know, I don't want to hone in on, oh, it's the big pharma. Oh, it's big marijuana. It's blah, 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 all these things. Then it becomes very easy to form these, like, niche resistance sites that just kind of fizzle.
Right. This is not in my concept, and I don't think you mentioned a lot of it in the book, but I think it's worth talking a little about it. What do you think the influence is of our widespread substance abuse as a civilization on the political extremism climate? Because I was thinking about it, if I were still in the conceptual place of a normal person, like I said, I would probably treat my seasonal affective thing with antidepressants or maybe other things. And you realize a lot of people, maybe 20, 25 more percent of the population, are hopped up on some form of psychiatric medicine. A lot of the youth are getting high every weekend with marijuana. We abuse alcohol. We abuse caffeine. I abuse caffeine a lot, you know, like, notorious for that a little bit. What do you think is the overall effect of these chemicals on the political climate? Does it affect it to any significant degree?
This is not an original thought of mine. I think Mark Fisher and Matt Parrott have made very similar comments to this end, that the, like, drug habit of a particular era is very closely bound up in, like, the overall energy of that period, economically, politically. And so, like, in the 80s, cocaine was the big drug. And it was, you know, everything was, there was the impression of America being super successful, winning the Cold War, just booms everywhere. And in the 90s, you get heroin. And then in the aughts, you get kind of a mixed bag, but predominantly marijuana, let's say predominantly marijuana. The psychedelic kind
And
of
meth.
revolution. Well, yeah, sure. Yeah.
Mean, how could we forget meth? I mean,
Yeah.
people are talking about America, the opioid crisis, but I think that the influence of meth is underestimated. Just, but I've not met many meth heads, but the few I've actually met are, see, methamphetamines, they're not very popular here in Macedonia. I don't think our chemists are interested in manufacturing it,
Keep it that
but
way.
the few people who are actually into methamphetamines and amphetamines in general, I've never met more unpleasant people in my entire life. And I've known, I was a corporate lawyer for a very long time. I've known a lot of coke heads. They're very pleasant, even when they're coked the fuck up, unless they're, this is, so just sorry for interrupting. Just
No,
go on with what you were
it's
saying.
true. It's yeah, there's there, it's not something that it's like an over it's like coke crystal meth is like the hyper modern version of cocaine, right? It's just like way more intense. There's it's yeah, it's a clearly worse. You had a little bit of LSD revolution, and then opiates are back again, and they've never really left. And the relationship between political violence or extremism and drug use.
And the prescription drugs. I mean, I
Yeah.
think my personal drug use has been strictly prescription, just what you might call it, antipsychotics, antidepressants, and I'm never putting any of that shit in my body ever, ever again. I'm really angry about what was done to me when I was too young to know better, but I think we underestimate the impact of these absolute mind destroyers on our civilization. So
Yeah, I
just
think that
carry
just the
on.
overall agitation and histrionicity, I think, is definitely a factor of the drug use. And there's so many different types that are being pushed for so many different reasons that, again, it's like how much you look at spiritual malaise and suicide rates, and you'd have to say opioids and heroin. You look at maybe like bourgeois metropolitan types that maybe don't really do anything politically. Maybe you talk about marijuana. Total like crazy burnouts, whether they're fascist or communist, you'd probably look at like certain types of, like you say, crystal meth or psychedelics or whatever the case is. I don't know how what that intersection really is like though. So not to whiff on that answer.
Yeah, I'm it's something that definitely merits investigation at the very least. The degree to which, well, the already bad social situation, already bad psychological situation is exacerbated by these chemicals. I mean, personally, as someone who has suffered greatly at the hand of prescription medicine, I'm strongly opposed to just handing it out like candy. People in the chat are mentioning the ill effects of Adderall on children. So that's something we're going to have to factor in. People are talking about, academic agent, he was talking about how Zoomers are this way and that way. We need to consider the possibility that the tenor of the Zoomer generation is going to be set by people who were put on literal drugs. Like something stronger than methamphetamine and opioids and whatever, during their formative years, during various stages of their developmental cycle or process. So I don't know. I don't know. It really merits further research, but it's something we should take into account. But we've been putting it off for a very long time. So Josh, would you give us an image of what the extremist, that elusive figure, looks like psychologically?
Yeah. So actually I had to crack out the book. It's like, what did I actually say on this subject? This is the funny thing. I don't know if this is the case for you, but I feel like when I do write, part of the writing is getting it out of the head so I don't have to think about it anymore. So
It
to not to go
is
back in,
definitely.
It's like, what?
But you know, the fun thing is, you know, you get to reread your work and marvel at what absolutely master of philosophy and thought you really are. It's just yeah. feed your narcissism. Not that it needs any feeding, but you know,
no, certainly not in my case. So the one of the concepts I did put forth was like this idea of the ideal ego and the ego ideal, which are, you know, just kind of mirror opposites of one another. And it's basically how one views themselves. Is there a standard that I am hoping to achieve by striving and suffering in pursuit of that ideal? Or is there an image of myself that I'd like to preserve because what I actually am like is so horrific and unacceptable to myself? And I think that latter one does explain quite a bit what the extremist is like, is I'm preserving, because again, you think about it, like the kind of person is going to go out of their way to make sure that, you know, your nephew, Steve, whose only job is pushing the grocery carts at the local shop in order, gets fired by somebody because they found a mean tweet somewhere. Like the kind of person who's going to hone in on just one totally inconsequential human with whatever, I mean, whatever the reason they did what they did was, that's like, you have to really do some heavy lifting to preserve an image of yourself that it can withstand like the obvious incomprehensible conclusions one could draw from your worldview. Why did I make sure that this 18-year-old kid lost his job? Why? It's like, well, he's, because I'm a good person. And then this goes into one of the other factors.
And he's a friend of the working class.
it's even more banal and stupid than that. It goes back to this idea of splitting, where there's just a firm kind of now in classical psychoanalysis, you'd say, well, it was an infantile break, a few months in the child's life. There's lots of things I don't like about psychoanalysis, so I don't emphasize these things. I just say this, if you're hearing this and you're thinking, let me look into it, just my two thoughts on that. But it's this like pre-individual phenomenon where the world only exists as things that satisfy me versus things that don't satisfy me. Everything in the latter category is total evil. Everything in the former category is total good. And I think that's a foundational part of left or right, although I really think this is like so emblematic of the left right now. The splitting of all external phenomenon, the upholding of this false image, which is kind of like therapeutically distancing me from the things that are true about myself that I don't like. And then I think some of the stuff probably we've all known and people have talked about for a very long time, which is the feminine nature of the left. I think there's a feminine nature to the right, which is also pathological, but it's like very clear. It's very, if you look at who's espousing these views anyway, going back several decades, it's predominantly Jewish women and liberal men and liberal Jewish men. But, you know, feminism and a lot of that queer theory, so much of this stuff tends to be a lot of lesbians, tends to be a lot of Jewish women. And I think that that's very close to the heart of like extreme leftism too, is just that uniquely pathological feminine worldview.
That's interesting. I will, for my part, add here, and that this sounds to me a lot like what Sam Vaknin would describe as narcissistic rage. And you know, you've had conversations with Sam Vaknin, you've studied his work, and I've studied his work for various reasons. When a narcissist's idealized image of himself is threatened, you know, and they're going to engage in bargaining, they're going to engage in denial, and if it's proven beyond doubt, and especially in public, they can very easily fly into a rage. Something I've noticed that I can unsettle leftists just by being myself, which is a highly educated, erudite, and, you know, non-meth abusing right-wing radical. And I'm not just saying to toot my own horn. This is all true of me. A very nice lady said this to me when I was handing out leaflets recently for an election in Macedonia. She knew me apparently from my neighborhood. How can a guy from you, from downtown, from your family, as educated as you are, so she knew about me, be with these nutters? And I'm like, well, this is what I believe. And she had no answer to that. She was trying to make me, it is very much to them seeing someone who is on the radical right, who does not conform to the, I guess, stereotype of the Bible thumping low IQ red stater or the meth smoking skinhead. It just breaks their minds. And this woman stands agape. Well, how is this possible? You know, I know for a fact, I know who you are. She knows me. Why are you doing this? I actually believe this. And that's something to think about. We have donations. Unless you want to add something, Josh.
No, I think that was pretty good. So we can move on.
Yeah. We have Alaska Chaga donating a Ninjagini on DLive, and he's asking us a question. Josh Neal's thoughts on the role of language in ideology. Nietzsche, a linguistics professor, said it shapes us. Well, Josh, you have any thoughts?
This is one that's tricky for me. So if you read like a lot of the French, like Lacan, they'll tell you that you're separated from the real the moment that language is introduced, and the real is this kind of inaccessible truth, just call it that, but that language, once language enters, you can never access again. And I think like generative anthropology, I think it makes similar claims about the particular influence language has on consciousness. I have no firm answer on this question. I'm not really sure what to make of it. Someone else who made it like a pretty definitive claim on the relationship between language and consciousness was Julian Jaynes, and the origin breakdown of consciousness in the bicameral mind, something like that. And it's
that's a fascinating concept, the bicameral mind.
Yeah, so
I don't know if we have the time, but we should discuss it sometimes. It's
sure.
It's, I don't know if it's true or not. It's just fascinating. I'm sorry.
That's how I feel about any question that tries to look at the relationship between language and consciousness. I think probably we have an inability. I think the shit is just ineffable. Put it that way. Shit is just really ineffable, motherfucker. And so whether we want to blame language or just how impossible it is to contemplate the fullness of being, I'm not sure.
Well, from my personal experience, I remember the time, I remember the time before I spoke English, and I remember the time before I spoke German. And there is definitely new avenues that new languages open for you. So for example, learning German it's like overlaying the world with something about the German word order overlays a paralogical lattice over the entirety of the world. It gives you a clarity about the natural world, which you don't get from, I guess you get it from other languages, but understanding German grammar and German word order, it makes nature make more sense. And this applies to the natural world, and this actually also applies to the order of human thought. And of course, before speaking English, I think English is uniquely well positioned from the three languages that I speak. I mean, sample size of three, but it's good for contemplation. It's a very contemplative language. You can use it to probe your own mind. Whereas, you know, I wouldn't know what the effects of Macedonian are because I'm a native speaker, so I don't know what it's like to not speak Macedonian. But I'm sure there are effects to people who come in from the outside. You know, people who have tried, and I wish Full Moon Ancestry was here with us because he tried to learn Macedonian. I don't know if he's progressing. He used to be my co-host, and he will be actually on White Rabbit Radio right after us. So you go watch him, people. So that's my answer to that. I've read some Lacan, I guess, but this would be very inhumane. So let's not even suggest it. I guess the way to learn about the way language would shape psychology is take biologically disparate people. So I'm thinking, take a bunch of Arab kids and raise them as Russophones. Take a bunch of Chinese kids, raise them as Germanophones. Take a bunch of German kids, raise them as Swahili phones, and try to measure, are there going to be cognitive differences between them and a control group of, you know, Arab children raised with Arabic language, Chinese kids. But this would be horribly inhumane, so let's not do it. Right.
I think there'd probably be also too many variables to, like, that.
Right,
would also
right,
be found.
Right. We would not be able to isolate just the influence of, and of course, you know, the transformations I experienced from learning German and English are ESL transform, you know, second language, third language transformations. And so again, we do not know if I had been raised with a different mother tongue, if I would be psychologically different, possibly. But that's the language is not the only variable. A lot of what my personality is informed by Macedonian culture, Macedonian folklore. Like I was rereading one book of Macedonian folktales, which I read as a very young child, and I realized this is like 80% of my sense of humor right here. And that wouldn't have been possible if I wasn't a native speaker. And it's actually had a very great effect on my language. People have commented that I speak Macedonian with a slightly archaic tint. This is because I love these old, I read these stories at very early age. And just such a big chunk of my personality comes from this cultural context, and not just from the language. No, from the attendant culture, right? And this is what annoys me. I love everyone in the chat. I love everyone who comes on this show. I'm not going to be able to share it with people, with all of these things I love. I'm not going to share it because I'm just not native speakers of Macedonian. Even if you learn the language, it's a very high context culture, so you can't just enter it. It's not like American culture, I guess. It's you got to be born into it. I'm sorry. This is a fascinating tangent, but it is a tangent nonetheless. We also have donations this time on Entropy from Mr. Love Hater, who has donated $88 with no comment. Well, that's highly appreciated, sir. You have bailed this show out from the financial end. And of course, feel free to ask questions if you want them answered. We are here for you, Mr. Neil, and I myself am at your disposal for the duration, for another, I would say, half hour, maybe less. So, Mr. Neil, that's the extremist. Now, you use the terms AEL, anti-social extremist leftists, and anti-social extremist rightists. And you claim that they are distinct biotypes, neurotypes. Now, I'm personally more interested in the phenomenon of the antisocial extremist rightists, because we know the left is crazy. We know these people are dysfunctional. And from reading your book, and if you read Mr. Neil's book, everything you believed about these people will be confirmed. They were bullied in high school, and they had weak fathers and domineering mothers. this is just Freudianism 101. But I'm far more interested in the problem of the antisocial extremist rightist, because you might have heard, Mr. Neil, the dissident right has a psycho problem and it has a retard problem. We call them Wignats. We call them all sorts of creative names, but they're here. They're making us look bad, And how do we defend against this? You're muted, Josh.
Yeah, it's a good question. I don't think I have the answer to that one. But there's, you know, there are certain things that I think are a consequence of the natural state that we're living within. Not trying to be too vague. So it's one, again, it's one of those situations where, like, I was not particularly excited to say anything, you know, one way or the other about our friend Ted. I feel similarly about this. There's so many external factors that put an undue level of pressure that it's kind of amazing that more people don't totally just have psychotic breaks like every single day. It actually is kind of amazing to me that doesn't happen. Just the sheer pressure and the fact that it's always right there.
This is why I brought the drug question, because, you know, people have commented, I'm a little strange in real life, but I'm like, considering I'm not on any mind-altering substances except caffeine, I'm actually pretty sane, because I know for a fact a lot of you quote-unquote normal people are scarfing down antipsychotics and SSRIs and weed and booze.
Yeah, well, so, what is it in New York alone? I think 1/4 of women are on SSRIs, so that's just the stuff people get prescribed that's on the books, and there's just such a profound, I want to say just drug culture, but kind of like, since you're in the corporate world, I guess you probably are familiar with this, just like everything is optimized and everything, like we're going to extract the most out of everything.
You're not even getting together with friends to smoke weed or drink booze. It's not a culture. It's not,
no,
there's nothing cultural about it.
This is a good point. Yeah, no, it's something imposed on, I think, and that's part of the problem. But that being said, you know, recognition of that, I think it goes a long way to stemming off the paranoia that is just endemic. Because it's all you have to really do, if you want to go back to like the Spellbinder analogy we were using, like all you have to do is make an insinuation one time, and the ripples of that one insinuation will pay dividends forever. Now it helps that in our case, it's not just an insinuation. it's well documented. And every time you read something in the news, invariably it's like, well, so-and-so was an informant was an FBI infiltrator or whatever the case is. So like that one guy who is like publishing weird occult books, but had like got like a stipend of a few thousand dollars to do it.
Sticks, so, picks, hammer.
No, I think he was in whatever like big dragnet operation just happened. Maybe it was Adam Waffen related types, I don't know. But that to me is, I think, like the most significant issue.
You think the guy who was both, you know, unironic Nazi and unironic Satanist?
That's probably exactly who I'm thinking of. I mean, there's unfortunately a lot of those people, like a lot. Select few that are promoted, whatever. So you think that there's a lot, but it's an archetype, put it that way.
Mm-hmm. Right. That's interesting. And of course, you describe these people. I find fascinating which you describe the antisocial extremist rightists' psychology is basically, I guess, dominated by feelings of inferiority, which, I mean, we all have these, I guess, from now and then, because we are, let's say, the weaker party in the conflict with Global Homo. We are struggling to stay on the platforms. We are struggling to get our message across. But it's just this internalizing of inferiority, which is, I guess, unhealthy.
Again, I say that, and it pains me as my fingers lift off the keyboard, because it's not something I want to overemphasize, because it's something that you hear so often. That part of the whole point of writing this was to push away from that direction. So yeah, like, okay, there's an inferiority complex. Everyone has one. Like you'll hear this said all the time. People with these views only hold these views because they're losers. They couldn't hack it in real life. And so of course they adopt these bitter, resentful, hateful views.
I have a friend who actually internalized that slur that we are losers. I'm like, what are you talking about? You're like, you're 6'3". You're built like a freight train. You are successful. You come from a wealthy and intelligent family. You're the exact opposite of a loser. You know, I'm short compared to you. Right? When we walk by the streets, women stare at you, not at me, and I'm a very handsome dude. So, and he says, no, we're losers. We are the far right. We're like, what the hell are you talking about? I'm really afraid of our guys internalizing this. I guess negative stereotype that exists about the far right. That, I'm sorry. What happened there?
Oh, I'm still here.
Right. Okay. This is a genuine danger. And I think by repetition, the propaganda eventually gets to our guys.
Well, yeah. So, I mean, and the truth of that is that most people are failing. Mm-hmm. So it's a smear that's true, but like so selectively applied that it loses its truth value. Now, like the example you just gave, like obviously that guy's not a loser, but if this were a parallel, you know, like Star Trek Mirror Mirror universe, then he would be like what the baron of a whole continent or something. like whatever measure of success you have now, like it stands to a certain kind of reason that in the world that we would want, there would just be crazy abundance, whatever. And I don't want to reduce it to, again, like a bunch of people who feel like that their dicks should be 8 inches longer and are mad that it isn't, and have this whole worldview.
No, it would drag on the ground.
Yeah, I know. It's already 30 inches, so I can't
exactly add, you know. But, this is actually just my dick painted blue and wrapped around my neck.
Right. Sorry. It's just practicality. So you got to do something with it. It's going to make it part of your fashion sense. But so like everyone's starting.
This is the writer's block, the most intellectual live stream on the planet. Sorry. I just couldn't resist. I'm sorry. I'm not even 30.
No. Sorry. The this phrase I used in the tweet earlier that I like is like the system has reneged on the promise of life. So just like the base expectation that you're not going to be in complete abject poverty and missing every milestone of human achievement that's possible. Like that's the bare promise of life. Okay, you're not, you know, not everyone's going to have Cindy Crawford and 10 children and Bitcoin millions and a huge mansion, but everyone within reason will live a, you know, an enviable quality of life. Food in the fridge, home, satisfying work engagement with their community, family, wife, blah, 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 husband. And not only do people not have that, they are like in the red. They are so far away from the possibility of attaining that. And it's not really an individual failing, or if it is, it's not predominantly an individual failing. And so this is like the thing with like psyops and whatever, where it really, the day you learn to never personalize them is the day that your total attitude towards life changes. Because in my view, I mean, so a lot of the stuff is really still so non-representative that the most important purpose it does serve is to harm you as someone that would be most sensitive to this thing being as predominant as they claim it is. So it's like you turn these things off, you realize that they're just there to hurt you. Then it becomes actually a lot easier to deal with life and think constructively about these kinds of issues. And then the same thing with paranoia, which I wanted to say before, like, and this is the subject of an essay that I'm publishing with Imperium Press shortly. You know, you want to get the most out of this kind of environment, then you have to treat this environment like you would an actual pub or a conference or a public venue or the street corner where there's actually a modicum of integrity and dignity that you need to present yourself with here, that alone like wipes out like the Fed problem and all these other issues, because you're holding yourself to a higher standard of social interaction. Frankly, the view that this is somehow like a playground that is just this place for the id to run wild and you can say all kinds of crazy insightful things. And again, I'm not trying to sound like a school marm, like a church nanny or whatever. Yeah, wag my finger, people, because just the point is like it's so juvenile and id dominated that's like, if you're worried about feds and honeypots and blah 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 blah, this person's a left wing infiltrator. It's like you can sift that out really easily by raising just the degree of professionalism that you bring to a project like this. Like if you're, I've been going at this for a while, so I'll make it real succinct right now. If you're here to save the white race, save America, save the West, raise masculinity, end the Fed, whatever your little slogan is, I don't say that to be denigrative, but like, no, act like it. Act like that's actually what you're trying to accomplish. And a lot of these problems just go away. Like that's the number one issue. We can talk about like the mentality of a right-wing extremist. This is, again, why I was hesitant about Ted Kaczynski earlier. It's like you pluck any one of these people, you scratch just a little bit behind the surface, and you see, social disintegration because of the family structure. You see economic disintegration. You see actual, proactive political involvement. You see all of these things that are behind, what's the meme of like the big dominoes and the kids laying down the first one? And it's like, okay, the guy who shoots up a church, well, each step below that was all of these ways in which that was made possible by the broader system. As we said earlier, not to take away the accountability from the actual violent act, but it's like there's just so many steps behind this that are more important to look at. I think I've gone on long enough.
No, I agree with you. We definitely need to treat politics as a serious matter. That's one thing, I guess, reading Schmidt rather than just quoting Schmidt on the internet will do to you. You start treating because he says politics is the most serious matter because it concerns matters of state, which are the most serious. It doesn't mean we don't joke around. Okay, humor is a human universal. We use, I joke around when I'm blowing off steam. My Twitter is, this way I instruct people to follow me on Telegram and our Gab, because on Twitter I'm just really just blowing off steam. And I don't use that site for political organizing anymore because it's just not useful in that way. As to the Fed question, I find that you can suss out federal infiltrators just by a sniff test, because a lot of these people have cop face. Now, this may be my privilege speaking. I got to check my privilege as an attorney, as someone who's had relatives who are police officers. I know a cop when I see them just from their physiognomy, but they also have certain behaviors. They have certain micro behaviors, which I don't want to enumerate them here because I don't really know how to name them, but I know a cop when I see a cop. And I think most people actually can, quote unquote, smell bacon. I think there's a lot of profoundly maladjusted people, autistics, schizophrenics, or borderline cases, just cannot see a very obvious, like the first, second, and third cop infiltrators, which are our domestic counterintelligence service sent after me here in Macedonia. I made them after 5 minutes, because these people just make no, they can lie, they can cheat, they can put on civilian clothing, but they cannot change their faces, they cannot change their habits, they cannot change their just whole disposition, this cop disposition they have. So a good deal of federal infiltration goes on into groups where people, I guess, do not have the necessary theory of mind to smell bacon, because there is a psychological type which becomes a policeman.
Sure. Yeah. And so don't get to more time.
Yeah. Yeah. And a lot of times you become a cop because your dad is a cop and there is a cop face and there is a cop look. Like there's a look they have in their eyes. And there's a peculiar way in which their nose faces you because like they're trying to sniff you out. Because a lot of this why I use smell metaphors. A lot of what we do with regard to other people is probably related to the sense of smell, you know. And cops, I don't know, there should be a study on this, but I wouldn't be surprised to learn that cops have a keener sense of smell than normal people. So,
I agree with that. And the something you raised before, which is like the lack of olfactory information in this is probably really significant, because a lot of the times you hear people will say that, you know, their accusations are based on like overly abstract issues. Like he used to believe X, now he believes Y. He used to like this thing you said now doesn't accord with what you said earlier. And I think that's just, there's a, like you point out, there's a more primary level that you can suss that kind of thing out. And as we've said throughout this program already, like, I don't think it's our mutual belief that that so much of this is ideological anyway. So like you just look at the face, smell the odors, and that'll give you more information. Of course, right. That's obviously harder because
no. I mean, I'm not kidding. I can tell a woman's IQ by smelling her. A woman will announce her IQ to you by her smell. The stupidest women will drown themselves in cheap perfume and slather makeup on themselves. I mean, look, this is like 6 years of lawyering, 6 years of insurance sales before that. There is a type. People will telegraph their personality to you by putting on clothes, makeup, perfume, by behaving in a certain way, by driving certain vehicles. You know, you saw me on the streets, you would make my personality immediately. You see me right now, you can make my personality more or less. Right. So that's the thing. And people are mentioning in the chat that Full Moon's dad was a cop. No, Full Moon Ancestry, he's well known to this community, but Full Moon is not a cop. No, unlike his dad, he did not become a cop and he doesn't have cop face. Whereas, you know, I've seen pictures of his dad and that's cop face. there is a type. Like I knew there was a one guy in my gym and he was working out, he's a middle-aged character. And I look at him and I say, that's a cop. We walked up to him. What do you do for a living? Oh, I'm a cop. You know, these things happen. Scent is fascinating to me, maybe because I'm personally hyperosmotic, but it runs in my family, which has a lot of police officers, you know. And I think it's one of our overlooked scents. I think we understand sight more or less. We understand hearing better than we think. We understand even taste, but I don't think we understand the power of smell. And this is why I'm reluctant to go, oh, we're going to build an online movement. I cannot smell you online. I mean, you can see you, although not fully, right? I do not have good depth perception of what you are doing right now, Josh. I mean, to me, you're just a face, but just not even a face, just the front end of a face. I cannot tell just how prominent your cheekbones are just from the angle you're in. So even my visual perception of you is incomplete, but I cannot smell you. I cannot see the way, all the ways in which your body moves, not just your face and hands, just your entire body moves when we're communicating, especially, you know, in the Mediterranean where we talk with our hands. This is actually true. You know, you hear it about Italians, you go to Italy, you understand that the stereotype does not go far enough. They use their legs when they talk. Like an Italian would swing from his hip to explain something. That's fascinating to me. We have donations. People are donating to the writer's block. Their generosity shall be remembered. We have Old Man Yinzer donating a lemon. We have Old Man Yinzer donating a diamond. And we have, I think we missed this one, the Thin Red Line donating a diamond and saying, we believe death is a lady sought by many in war. From what I understand, this is heathen wisdom. Yeah, a lot of people go to war not to win, but to be annihilated in the conflagration. And there is a particularly poignant and powerful, I believe it's a Spanish love song. It could be Italian, could be Spanish. I've heard it in both languages. It's about a man who loves a woman, as these things are, but she does not love him back. And he gives her one last chance. He gives himself really one last chance to win her. And if he does not, he is going to join the French Foreign Legion, which he goes to war not to win. That's something you realize at the end of the song. He's essentially threatening to commit suicide in a socially acceptable way. It's a very tragic, very poignant song, and it's based on many such cases, many such cases. You know, a lot of people, I actually know people who've served in the Foreign Legion. There's still a lot of love lost in that military unit. And we have donations on Entropy. We have ABC donating $5, and he asks, can psychology, mass psychology in particular, shape a strategy for populist right-wing movements in order to make the transition from fringe to mainstream? What would some basic principles look like? Well, Mr. Neil, I believe this is the question I posed you to you at the very beginning. Is psychology just a racket for the Jews, or can we use it to our ends?
Psychology is one tool in a among our it's one weapon in our many armaments, and I would be hesitant to say that there's one weird psychological trick to mainstreaming your fringe political ideology, but I think the goals are much more modest. They really should be much more modest because I think our ambitions, I'll put it this way. I'm an American. I grew up here. I've lived my whole life here. To me, being a white man, a lot of it means being in charge of the world because that's just what my experience of living in America is. And while I don't really think that's technically true, nonetheless, that's the image that's presented. And so I think, for me, what makes sense a lot more is to kind of recede a little bit. I mean, you hear this when people talk about secession, they talk about civil war, they talk about segregation, they talk about all of the national divorce, they talk about all these things. And I think it speaks to a reality that a lot of people are accepting, which is we need to pull back a little bit. We need to reconsider our position. We need to reconsider a lot of things before going back out and playing the whole empire game. So I the only psychological advice I could offer is to simply think as small as possible. It's the most anti-American thing almost, is to think much smaller because everything is big. And even as I say that, like there's been this minimalist push.
America is a big country. It's, I want, maybe I don't want to open this avenue of digression, but we should maybe not less language. We should look at the impact that growing up in a country of such great distances has on the mind. Because I can get in my car and be in another country within 20 minutes here, but not in America. You got to travel for 5 hours to reach the next town.
Yeah, 90 minutes gets me from one end of Long Island to the other.
Right.
4 hours and I'm just further up New York. So yeah, the massive size is a big thing. And my generation in particular has seen the minimalist kind of aesthetic and moral imperative more and more develop itself in the public consciousness, which complicates what I'm saying, because what I'm saying actually seems to be in lockstep with what the system is saying. Smaller, think smaller, own less, you'll be happy, blah 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 blah. The ends are different, I think, is between how I'm using this and how like Klaus Schwab or whatever might use this, which is you should deign to have less because you're wicked and climate change and racial equity and so on and so forth. Whereas for me, it's more like Americans, I think, have had such a diluted sense of their own self, as global people, as just country people, as town folk on every level. I think being in the empire distorts everything about how you think. An idea for an essay I have is post-imperial subjectivity, which is kind of, I guess, answering the question that this person asked, which is like, what should we internally be like for this future world that we all want? It's taken me a long time to say it. I don't actually have the answer to that question, but it is something that I think we have to think to, and as Americans in particular, because I don't know much about any other part of the world, there's a lot of like reaccommodating to reality that just we need to do, and because it's our problem, I think, really, at this point, it's definitely a global problem, but the Zog or gay, GAE, or whatever you want to call it, while it has its fingertips everywhere, we're the husk that it's like drawing a lot of its life force from. So that kind of makes it more our responsibility, I think. So minimalism, but not like Klaus Schwabian minimalism, I guess, just to give some kind of answer to this poor soul who asked this question.
That's actually a good answer. And of course, I've written an essay, several, I think, which exhorts Americans to really abandon the empire as a concept, because if they don't, it will drag them down with itself when it finally falls. Instead, they should focus on discovering their nationhood, scale back from nation from empire to nation. And there will be a Nicholas R. Gilvey essay on countercurrents.com in the future, which will concern what can the American Empire learn from the Ottoman Empire with regard to scaling back into a nation, as the Turks have, with a degree of success, done. So that will be, for my part, if ABC is interested, a good percentage of my work on countercurrents is an attempt to psychologically profile who is the dissident, right? Who we are. And I think that can shine a light on our predicament here. We can definitely use psychology to see what it is about the dissident. What's the neurotype? What's the type of person which the dissident right attracts? And then maybe do targeted advertising, targeted recruiting, and of course, stop trying to recruit people who are neurotypically very different from us. This is why, I mean, I've given up on this idea of we're going to red pill normie conservatives. They're just temperamentally very distant from us, more distant than the left even. So that's, and of course, Reed Johnson in the chat saying, I prefer to profile oligarchs. There is a sociological profile of the aristocracy of the, I mean, the current elite, the current ruling class of Davos Man, up on countercurrents.com. It was written by Peter, I want to say Harbel, the Czech sociologist. If our heroic mods would kindly look for that essay and post it in the chats on DLive and Odyssey. I'm just blanking on the man's name, even though he wrote what is possibly one of the most important essays on countercurrents.com. So if our heroic and indomitable mods would do exactly that. We have another donation from Love Hater for $14. Wow. Well, he donated the 88 first before the 14. So I guess that's what you get from Nietzsche and transvaluation, huh? He says, I feel superior to everyone on the left because they're fuckwits. Does this make me a bad person or just really awesome? Dr. Neil, you are a doctor, right?
No, I don't have a PhD.
Okay, Mr. Neil,
Yes, please.
is Love Hater a bad person or just really awesome?
Feels like we're doing Love Line now. Did you have
Maybe we should.
a I don't think it matters. One of the things I also am trying to say in this book is like, just take the monkey off your back. A lot of the stuff doesn't matter. If none of us really believe in democracy, then you shouldn't care what your opinion means. Because nobody else cares what your opinion means. You know what I mean? Like, at a certain level of like being anti-democratic is like just having so little regard for any of the expectations that your opinions matter. I mean, I write this book and I don't think my opinion matters. You know, I do this because, I mean, what else am I going to do? I'm a man in the world with a certain set of skills. This, I'm just living out my destiny here. But I don't have any, you know, grand delusion that this is going to be ushering in some great future, whatever. Same principle with this guy. Like, doesn't matter. I mean, probably a lot of them are. Would you say fuckwits, fucktards? Maybe they're not. If they're not, you should want to correct where you're wrong, because I think you'll have a happier life. Heuristics are good, but they're not algorithms. So they're kind of always, they have a higher failure rate. If you care a lot about being consistent, then yeah, maybe look into that. If you're happy, like, who cares? Like, I don't know what to say to that.
For my part, I mean, these people, there's a good deal of fuckwittery on the left, but they are winning right now. You know, they've been winning consistently for 500 years, maybe more. So maybe there's a method to their fuckwittery, huh? I don't think we should feel superior to them. I think we should have a long, hard think about who we are, what we are, and why the right, and not just the mainstream right, the dissident right, we've been consistently losing to these people for a very, 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 very long time. People are always saying return to tradition, but tradition lost to liberalism. Why? We got to ask these questions, not just feel superior to the left. And but you are a good person. You're definitely not a bad person, a love hater. You are awesome, if only for donating to Countercurrents and the Writer's Block. That's definitely an awesome act, and I thank you for it, kind sir. Let me just refresh the donation page, and if there are no donations, I think we can conclude tonight's episode with Mr. Neil. He's not a doctor, not quite yet, and you know, I wouldn't trust him if he earned a PhD in this toxic fucking environment we have here and right now. It's like the mark of Cain having a PhD in this day and age, I guess. Josh, any closing remarks you have for the audience?
Just that it was a pleasure talking to you. I hope everyone enjoyed it. I have a few things I'd like to plug really quickly. Mm-hmm. The Firstness Journal, Joel Davis is the editor. He's publishing on Imperium Press sometime soon. Will be the third edition, and it'll be my debut as a writer. Mm-hmm. For Firstness. I have an essay prepared called Ethos and the Internet, which I think is very good. I think it's actually much better than anything in here, so I would highly recommend that you check it out. I think it's probably free on the website, firstness.org. Few more essays in the pipeline, which I'd like to publish again with Joel, and down the line, Tyler Hamilton, when his journal is up and running, which hopefully I'm not spoiling anything by announcing that there's a journal in the works. Maybe there isn't. I don't know. Could be hearsay. Another book for Imperium Press, probably late next year, called Suspicious Minds, Conspiracy in the Age of Hypermodernity. And I want to do very similar to what I did here with American Extremist, is look at conspiracy theories as a psychological and political phenomenon and kind of dissect what they are and how people get caught up in them. It's not looking at any one conspiracy, so, and it's not making judgments about which are correct or which are incorrect or what's the right conspiracy versus what the wrong conspiracy is. Just generally kind of looking at the phenomenon and its significance, because even now QAnon is more or less still in the rearview mirror, but people talk about it. And now the January 6th thing is like a conspiracy, and people are still, obviously the Russia thing never goes away. There are all these conspiracies, which, you know, if you think about like in the preceding century, it was almost like a very noble, serious investigative pursuit to like uncover who killed MLK or JFK or Gulf of Tonkin. And now it's really childish stuff like
It's not even discovery. I mean, we're going to open a big old digression here, I guess, but I'm just fascinated by QAnon and its persistency and the richness of its lore. But at the same time, I can see, again, this is like the effect of German on the mind. I can see the outline thereof from millenarian Protestant cults. It's a millenarian cult. And it's no wonder that it thrives in America, which is notorious for its millenarian cults. I've been trying to be ecumenical and not rag on Protestants too much, but it's just this is a heresy particular to that denomination, I guess. And I think we're going to be talking about it in the sense of if we are serious about dissecting the psychology of the modern American. We're going to be talking about QAnon. We're going to be talking about the Russia conspiracy for a very long time. We're going to be talking about Epstein. We're going to be talking
Oh,
about,
yeah.
oh, what's his name? The January 6th terrorist incursion into the Capitol. I'm sorry, I got to do the voice. I love doing the voice. But we are all out of time. We said 90 minutes, it's been 121 minutes. But this has been the writer's block, people. Now, what I want you to do, I want you to go over to Imperium Press and I want you to find American Extremist by Josh Neal. If our heroic and indomitable mods would just post that into the DLive and Odyssey chats so people can have easy access to this fine tome of psychological wisdom. And I want you to purchase that fine book and I want you to read it. It's very important. Don't listen to this guy. Don't listen to this guy. It's one of the more important books I've read recently. And I read a lot. I read a lot of books. It's maybe too many books. And this has been the Writer's Block with Josh Neal. You should also follow him on Twitter. Now, I have here in the show outline a discussion of how Twitter is full of feds. It's basically a glow site. But for the time being, Mr. Neal is just there. If I can prevail upon him to make a Telegram or Gab account, you should also follow him there. But for the time being, it's just Twitter. And of course, you should go to countercurrents.com. You should read. You should support Imperium Press. You should support Mike and Joel. This is the second time we are reviewing a Imperium Press book. On the writer's block, and the first time you could say we have the author, if only because necromancy failed to bring George Fitzhugh back to life. We'll have a discussion about that next week on the writer's block. We're going to be discussing the occult because it's spook day, it's Halloween, I guess. And if you would be so kind as to follow me on Telegram and Gab, this is where most of my serious political thinking goes on. The unserious stuff goes on Twitter. Don't follow me there. And once again, people, this has been the Writer's Block. I'm your friend, host Nicholas R. Gilvey. This has been a show with Josh Neal about his book, American Extremist. So bye-bye and take care.
Cheers.